From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Melissa Block. Apple announced today that it will start selling its iPad in Verizon stores, and that's got a lot of people excited, not because of what it means for the iPad, but because of what it could mean for the iPhone. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Imagine if the iPhone and AT&T were dating. It seems like AT&T got really lucky, because AT&T is a nice enough guy, but he's just not that good looking. But the iPhone?
The virtues of this girl. I would say sexy, gorgeous, fashionable.
Thomas Hubble, who lives in Ithaca, New York, wants the iPhone to date other people. But as long as she's hitched to AT&T's cell phone service, he won't take her out. Hubble is among a large number of people who say AT&T's service is inferior to Verizon's. Hubble's been looking for signs that the monogamous relationship between AT&T and the iPhone may soon be over.
You know, I've expected it for a long time, but never really saw any viable signs that it was happening until the past month or so.
In the last month, major news organizations have quoted anonymous sources who say that Apple will release an iPhone on Verizon. But today's announcement that the iPad would be sold in Verizon stores is the clearest sign yet. Charles Golvin is an analyst at Forrester Research.
So I think this is a harbinger of a deeper relationship between Verizon and Apple in the relatively near future.
Back when Apple first released the iPhone, they had good reasons for hitching up with AT&T. There are two kinds of cell phone networks. The one Verizon uses, called CDMA, is considered to be more reliable in the U.S. But Apple wanted to sell the iPhone all over the world, so they went with AT&T's GSM technology.
Because that is the technology that is most widely used throughout the world. More than 80% of the subscribers in the world.
But not in the U.S., where Verizon's technology is generally believed to provide superior phone service. Ed Zittrin, who has an Android phone, says he only has it because Verizon's network is better. But if the phone goes to Verizon...
But I'd definitely drop my Droid for an iPhone 4 if it did.
Today's announcement that the iPad will be sold at Verizon stores is giving him hope that he will soon be able to drop his Droid. But there have been rumors for years about an end to the iPhone's monogamous relationship with AT&T, so he's not uncorking the champagne just yet. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A couple of weeks ago, Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, took the stage at a tech conference in San Francisco, and he rolled out his vision for the future of search technology, the future of mobile computing, the future of human life, right down to the way we get around.
Computers will clearly be good at doing the things that we're no good at. Your car should drive itself. It's amazing to me that we let humans drive cars. Computers should drive cars. It's obvious, right? If you think about it. And all of a sudden, it'll be much, much safer when we let the computers do the things that they're good at and the humans can talk or eat or whatever they want to do in the car. You get the idea.
Well, you know, not everybody at that meeting did get the idea. It really wasn't clear at the time if this was some kind of utopian joke or if Schmidt was really serious. But then last weekend, Google announced that its engineers are indeed designing cars that drive themselves. You know, this isn't a revolutionary idea. It's been kicked around by tech enthusiasts for quite a while. If you've been reading the science and tech magazines for the past decades, you've seen them. For example, let me read from an issue of Popular Science way back in May of 1958. It says, "The car that drives itself, your car in the future, will be run by black boxes while you watch." Or we can go to August of 1958 in Popular Mechanics, where it says, "This car has electric brains." So whatever happened to those 1950s cars with electric brains or cars that would drive themselves? And could Google be the one that finally brings the robotic car to the road? Harry McCracken is the founder and editor of Technologizer. That's a website about personal technology. And he's a columnist for Time.com, and he dug up those old magazine articles for a piece he wrote this week on robotic cars at Technologizer.com. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. McCracken.
Hi, Ira.
Did you follow those old articles as well as I did? I used to love reading those things. I don't know if you're as old as I am to have read them when they first came out.
You know, it's a topic that comes up constantly in both popular science and popular mechanics. And I think probably as long as there have been automobiles, there's been a notion that maybe they should just drive themselves. And big companies have invested effort in doing that. And wacky inventors working on their own have done it too.
Yeah, and what has been the reaction to this Google idea and these ideas in general? Do people really want to do this, or do they feel fearful that if they're not driving the car is going to get into some kind of trouble or crash or something like that?
I think it's an odd excitement at the idea, and also nervousness. Anybody who uses a computer knows that computers make a lot of mistakes, in part because they're programmed by human beings who make a lot of mistakes. And
right.
It's just such an ambitious idea. I mean, there aren't many things a human does that involve dexterity and reading and thinking and a fast reaction to things that change millisecond by millisecond in the way that driving does.
Yeah. You were at that conference where Schmidt rolled out the vision. What was your immediate reaction as he was speaking about it?
Well, he had sort of a cryptic smile and was being mysterious. And at the time, I kind of wondered whether Google saw this as something they might be involved in, but I did not expect to learn shortly thereafter. They actually have put a lot of resources into this for quite a while.
A couple of years ago, we talked about a DARPA race with cars to try to come up with a race that the car could drive itself around a closed course. And if I read what Google is doing, they've hired all those folks who worked on that race to make a car for them.
They kind of have a dream team of a lot of the people who won those races. Obviously, the Defense Department is very interested in the idea of self-driving vehicles, and there's actually a bill that says it should be the goal of the Defense Department to have one-third of the ground vehicles in the military be self-driving by 2015. So DARPA has given away millions of dollars to scientists who have built vehicles that have driven themselves. And for that contest, it's been done in the Mojave Desert and in Air Force bases and places where there aren't going to be any random pedestrians, as opposed to what Google has done, which is to send these cars out on roads in California.
Mm-hmm. But they're not – did they run them in through traffic, through all kinds of traffic with no problems?
You know, apparently the most serious issue was something when they were rear-ended by somebody, and so apparently it wasn't Google's fault. Most of the driving they've done, there has been a human being there who's intervened occasionally when something has happened, like a bicyclist running a red light. Mm. They've done 140,000 miles with only a little intervention, and they say about 1,000 miles with no intervention.
You know, you can actually now document the first time that a robotic car got into trouble and said, it's not my fault. So, as opposed to people always saying, it wasn't my fault. Now their car can say, it's not my fault. what makes this car work so much better when all those cars in the 50s and in popular mechanics and stuff like that did not get produced?
Well, in the past, a lot of the time, the basic notion was to essentially send cars along a track. And sometimes it was a physical track, and sometimes it was an electronic one. You know, GM tried embedding radio cables in the road and having control boxes along the side of the road that would issue commands to cars. And Google's system is a lot closer to replicating what a human being does. It uses radar and machine vision to see the road and see other cars and people and signs. Obviously, Google already has a tremendous amount of data about the rules of the road and where the one-way streets are and so forth, which it uses. So it's much closer to looking around, thinking, understanding what you should be doing, and reacting appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone. Sharif in Burke, Virginia. Hi, welcome.
Yeah, hi. Actually, I'm an engineer here in the D.C. area, and I've been following this technology for quite a while, and was in grad school when some of my friends, my colleagues, were working on that DARPA project. In fact, one of my colleagues at my company now was formerly on the Case Western team for that DARPA challenge.
Hmm.
And I'm a firm believer in self-driving cars. I feel that if we're not going to make a solid investment in high-speed rail or other kinds of transportation that sort of go beyond the vehicle, then perhaps we should look to self-driving cars. But my understanding is that the policy, in this case, it's the policy that lags far, far behind the technology. So are you aware of any policymakers or potential policies that are sort of being tossed around right now?
What kind of policies? What kind of policies
forward?
What kind of policies would we need? For example, we need traffic laws that are different, or
you know, I think it's more like insurance policy.
I see. Let me ask Harry.
There's a huge amount of infrastructure and laws and things like insurance policies that relate to cars, and they all have one thing in common. They assume a human being is driving, and clearly if this becomes reality at any point, a lot of that has to change. Google says that they're confident that what they have been doing was legal, but even then they said they give a heads up to the police departments in the areas where they drove because for a century now, we've assumed that cars are driven by a human rather than by artificial intelligence.
All right, Sharif, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I guess you could foresee that if this idea catches on, it might do away with some cars, right? I mean, why would people who need to go to the grocery store and maybe there'd be services like taxis without people in them. You just dial up, a car comes, picks you up, takes you to where you'd like to go. Without you having to
not.
Drive.
I'm also be fascinated to see how it changes people's reactions to their cars because, Americans love to drive their cars, and it's partially about getting places, but it's also about a relationship with a vehicle. And if you're not steering and accelerating and enjoying the experience, maybe you'll drive less. Mm-hmm.
You wrote an article in Technologizer going through the history of these ideas of cars that drive themselves. Can give us a flavor of three or four of those ideas.
Sure. Well, there have been a bunch of them, and a lot of them kind of remind me of things I saw in Tomorrowland at Disneyland.
Oh, yeah.
When I was a kid. My favorite, I think, is one called the Urbmobile, which the Cornell Aeronautical Laboratories was working on in the 60s. And the Urbmobile was a car that you could drive traditionally. It was electric, but you could do it yourself on roads. But they also anticipated that maybe by 1985 or so, there would be these tracks, these highways that were made of tracks, and if you didn't feel like driving, you could drive your Urbmobile onto the tracks, and it would sort of become a self-driving car then, kind of like a loosely coupled railway car.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255, a tweet from Ted Pavlik came in. It said, there's stimulus money funding cyber-physical system research in autonomous urban vehicles. Are you aware of that?
I haven't heard of that, but over the years, a lot of the research that's been done has been funded by the government, dating back to the 60s at least.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we are close to this kind of car? Or research, we always say we're always 10, 20, 30 years away with something like this.
Compared to some of the organizations that have done this in the past, I think Google is being smart enough not to say this will all be reality by a given date. John Markoff had a very good story on the Google car in the New York Times. He said the most optimistic predictions are maybe we're 8 years away from something happening with this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's absolutely true. It's not just about the technology. It's about legislation and all kinds of stuff. And even once the technology exists, do the big car companies start building into cars automatically? What happens to all the non-self-driving cars out there? Do you have to take them off the road, or can they interact with the self-driving cars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not something that's going to happen overnight, and it's going to take a lot of infrastructure to be put into place before any of this happens.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Harry, for taking time to be with us today and going down memory lane.
My pleasure.
A little bit. Harry McCracken is the founder and editor of Technologizer. That's a website about personal technology, and he's a columnist for Time.com.
Try to buy some concert tickets or create a new email account, and you're usually confronted with a puzzle of sorts. A box appears with a distorted word that sometimes isn't even a word, and you have to retype it. If you tilt your head or squint your eyes, you usually can make it out. And that's the point. These puzzles are called CAPTCHAs. A human can decipher them, but a computer set up by a spammer or a hacker can't. So, to get around the problem, spammers and mass ticket purchasers have outsourced CAPTCHA solving to teams of low-wage workers in places like Russia and Southeast Asia, and many of them don't speak English. Stefan Savage is a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of California, San Diego. He recently co-wrote a paper on the economics of this underground CAPTCHA trade, and he joins us now from UCSD. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So there's this outsourcing of CAPTCHA solving. How does this work? I mean, you're finding other humans to solve these CAPTCHAs instead of computers?
Precisely. So the whole premise behind the CAPTCHA is you want to allow users to access your service as long as they're an actual person, but you don't want to allow miscreants on the internet to sign up for, say, hundreds of thousands of Hotmail accounts. And so you put this screen in the way that a human can solve, but a computer can't en masse. So what these miscreants did in response is they simply outsourced the task of solving them to effectively sweatshop labor, where people will just sit and be given these images to solve, and we'll type them in all day.
Usually these CAPTCHAs have to be solved pretty quickly to get through to the site. So how fast are these workers?
They, generally speaking, can turn around a CAPTCHA in between 10 and 20 seconds. They're probably a little better at it than we are because they do it all day.
But what if they don't speak English?
They don't need to speak English. The beauty of most modern CAPTCHAs is that they simply take Latin characters, so they don't actually need to understand what the words mean. They simply need to be able to look at the symbols and type the appropriate ones on their keyboard.
How much are they paid?
Very little.
Oh.
So on the labor side, the going rate is about 75 cents per 1,000 CAPTCHAs solved. It's about $2 or $3 a day. And it's really in line with some of the lowest paid textile work around, although probably the quality of life is slightly better than being at a textile mill.
Is it legal to do this?
It's something of a gray area. It's not clear what law is being broken in simply solving the CAPTCHAs. Hmm. The solvers themselves, particularly in other countries, it's not clear that in fact they're breaking a law, even though fundamentally what they're doing is supporting a fraudulent activity.
Is this a big problem?
No, so the interesting thing about this is that on the one hand, CAPTCHAs do not keep the bad guys out. But at the same time, they actually are effective at keeping the problem in control. So even at that very low cost, 75 cents, say, per thousand, they have to be able to make enough money, send enough spam from each one of those accounts that it ends up being worthwhile. And so even that very low drag turns out to be enough to weed out a huge number of the people who would play this game.
Stefan Savage is a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of California, San Diego. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Melissa Block. It's not every day that opera singers share a stage with robots, unless the opera company is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Death and the Powers is the latest high-tech opera developed at MIT's Media Lab, which celebrates its 25th anniversary today. Reporter Shannon Mullen got a tour of the lab and a peek behind the opera curtain.
Robots are the first performers to take the stage in Death and the Powers. If you're picturing R2-D2 or WALL-E, you're way off. The opera bots are barely humanoid, with plastic tubes for bodies and heads like triangular pizza boxes. The set is robotic too, but the libretto, by poet Robert Pinsky, is quintessentially human. It centers on Simon Powers, an aging inventor obsessed with mortality, who builds a system he uploads himself into so he'll exist forever. Composer Todd Machover chose the theme.
I'm kind of middle-aged now, so my parents are getting older, my kids are. So I think a lot about aging and mortality and generations and how you pass along all the detail and texture of somebody's life to somebody else.
Like any storyteller, Machover wants the audience to think about the same things his characters do.
Where does a human life stop and where might technology take over? But even more basic questions like, what is our legacy and what form can we put the essence of each of us in to share with others?
I came from light and I will return to love.
Though Macover developed Death and the Powers at MIT, where he teaches in the Opera of the Future program, he does most of his composing in an 18th century barn outside of Boston.
It's got all kinds of surprises in it. So this is the main part where I work, and to have a place like this that feels so connected with history, you know, you can just smell the past in here. There's something about that that makes me feel wonderful every time I come in here.
Now picture MIT's Media Lab, an ultra-modern building with mile-high ceilings, sparkling glass walls, and wide-open workspaces. It's where dozens of 20-something students designed the opera's technology.
I've been working on the wearable sensor system and audio analysis that the main character of Simon Powers uses to go from being a physical actor into an entire set.
That's 24-year-old PhD student Ellie Jessup. She's talking about the second scene in the opera when Powers uploads himself into his system and becomes the set. For the rest of the show, the baritone who plays the role performs out of sight, a la The Wizard of Oz. He's actually below stage, hooked up to the computer system Jessup helped design. To demonstrate, she puts on special gloves, armbands, and body sensors. And as she speaks and gestures, patterns of light dance on a big flat-screen TV representing the set.
When I quickly move, suddenly everything explodes on the screen. Large gestures make it very active. As I breathe in, things get stiller and the color changes from blue to red.
On stage, three huge triangular walls made of LED tubes light up, change color, and move around. There is a traditional orchestra in this show, but Macover says it's amplified through a 3D surround sound system that's meant to put the audience inside Powers' system.
The end of I won't give it away, but the kind of climactic moment of the opera, the sounds fill the space in such a way that it sounds like the walls like blow off the theater.
All of this technology might be a turnoff for some traditionalists, but on the other hand,
this has the potential for creating a fantastic new audience.
Sharon Daniels is a soprano who's performed internationally and now runs Boston University's Opera Institute.
This is something that just excites the daylights out of me because this is like an extreme of what we're training our singers to be prepared for. Reinterpreting, reinventing, embracing the new, and I think that's all good.
Still, Daniels doesn't see a lot of opera companies adopting this approach. For one thing, it's even more expensive to stage than traditional opera. With so much technology, a lot could go wrong in a live performance. And it begs the question, will people pay more attention to all the gizmos than the story? The opera's production designer, Alex McDowell, says no.
I don't think an audience thinks about the mechanics of theater. And if we do our job right, an audience in any kind of theatrical context dives into an immersive relationship with the story.
This is McDowell's first opera. He's a veteran Hollywood production designer whose resume includes blockbuster sci-fi films Watchmen and Minority Report. He says the technology in this show might help sell tickets, but it's not a gimmick.
You know, the story is that the human disappears. A kind of robotic entity has been left behind. I don't think there is any option but to use technology to tell that story.
Death and the Powers made its world premiere in Monaco last month and starts a U.S. tour this winter. But Todd Macover is already dreaming up his next show, and he says this time he wants to create something really different. For NPR News, I'm Shannon Mullen in Boston.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The tech company Google continues to inch its way into the clean energy industry. This past week, Google announced a major investment in a huge undersea project designed to bring electricity from offshore wind farms to the cities of the mid-Atlantic. One of the biggest challenges in the whole debate over clean energy is getting the power from the remote areas on land or sea to the population centers that need it. And as NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, there's an ocean of red tape and bureaucracy to get through first.
The wind farms that would send power on this new offshore grid don't even exist yet. But Google and Transelect, the company planning to build the $5 billion project, say once they get approval, wind developers will come running. It seems simple enough, but not if it's anything like ITC Holdings' experience. That company has been trying to build a massive transmission line to connect the windy Great Plains to power-hungry Chicago and points east.
It definitely has been a regulatory quagmire.
Linda Blair is a vice president of the Michigan-based transmission company.
If we did not have any of sort of the regulatory quagmire, we could build it within 2 years.
Instead, the company estimates it will take at least 10 to 15 years. The project needs a slew of approvals from an array of federal and state agencies and regional organizations. There are studies to be done on impacts to wildlife, landscapes, and historic treasures. And people often oppose the lines because they don't want them in their backyards. Offshore cables face additional hurdles because different federal agencies are in charge that haven't even written regulations yet. Blair is skeptical about Google and Transelect's projections that they'll start laying cable offshore in 3 years.
They clearly need to not underestimate the regulatory burden that exists on getting transmission infrastructure built in this country.
Energy Secretary Stephen Chu says he's troubled by the shortage of transmission lines for clean energy. He was talking about the problem this week with his assistant secretary in charge of electricity.
And I said, well, can we get it to go faster? And she said, well, it's actually moving much faster than it used to move.
But he says clearly not fast enough. The problem is that historically, new transmission lines have been built after new power plants. Deborah Liu of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory says it's difficult to reverse the order. That's because public utility commissions usually have to show that the power from a certain plant is needed by their customers before they can give their approval and pass on the huge costs of building the lines.
Essentially, in most cases, a utility would have to put out that money ahead of time and bear the risk that maybe the wind developers don't show up. And that's a lot of risk to take.
Texas has broken the logjam. It has been building new lines to windy areas before wind farms set up shop. But the process becomes much trickier when multiple states are involved. Still, Lou is ecstatic that a hot company like Google is taking on this extremely nerdy challenge. And if the company's executives ask for her advice,
I would tell them, go full speed ahead. I think this is a great move, not just to try and jumpstart offshore wind development, but also to highlight how we need to really work on this transmission problem and get past some of these regulatory barriers.
But some experts aren't so upbeat. None of the developers of current offshore projects are ready to sign up for Google's grid. R.J. Lyman is a lawyer who represents renewable energy developments. He says given how expensive offshore wind farms are, it might be those projects that fail Google's grid and not the other way around.
Sometimes you build a highway to nowhere, but then things grow up around it. Before you know it, the McDonald's, the Walmart get built. Maybe that will happen here.
Lyman worries that the huge costs and permitting challenges will prevent those offshore wind projects from ever being built. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Let's talk next about a new study on how people in this country connect with each other. The Pew Internet and American Life Project has been looking into the relationship between Americans and their gadgets.
When I was driving in the cab over here, my cab driver was listening to NPR on the radio, talking to one of his friends on his Bluetooth, and texting someone else with his other cell phone.
When he should just be listening to NPR for safety. Safety. That's Aaron Smith, author of the Pew study.
My personal favorite statistic from our research is that 96% of 18 to 29-year-olds own a cell phone. And, you know, you can't get 96% of any group to agree on anything.
Among Americans of all ages, mobile is in. People are buying more laptops and smartphones and fewer desktop computers, and more seniors, people 65 and older, are going digital.
Seniors, for instance, are the fastest growing group in terms of their use of social networking sites. And we also found in this study that 6 in 10 seniors own a cell phone.
Okay, the study says the typical American under the age of 45 owns 4 gadgets, things like smartphones, MP3 players, e-book readers like the iPad or the Kindle. Smith says these new media gadgets are continuing to change the way Americans live.
you've got a few minutes free. You can text your friends. You can call someone. You can play a game on your cell phone. You can listen to music on your iPod. So, yeah, the times where you were just sitting at a table, kind of doing nothing or just contemplating the world, I think are becoming fewer and further between as more of these technologies permeate our daily lives.
No more contemplating. Consumers have an array of high-tech choices, and that has sent traditional media outlets reeling in recent years. But Smith says the news for journalists is not all bad.
People are actually consuming as much, if not more, news content on a daily basis than they've done really at any point in the recent past. And what they're doing is they're adding new technologies into the mix. What we see in our research is people getting a lot of news, but in ways that are different and new from what we saw as of a few years ago.
Aaron Smith says the challenge is how to capitalize on those trends.